So you should ask yourself, with every decision you make, is this good for the company?
Let's go. Coming to you from the basement of the basement of WCPT 820 in Chicago, it's the Sports Cubicle, where the inmates run the asylum and the boss is mad at us because we're working overtime to get you some big stories of the week. Like, hello, Black Sox and Pete Rose. Move over because Shohei Ohtani might have just said, Watashi no biru omotete. Mercado talks to Josh Buckholter about the state of the Chicago Bears after trading away Justin Fields a week ago and basically signaling that they're going to go after Caleb Williams in the NFL draft. Devin and I talk about the state of the White Sox as they start their season this week at home against the Detroit Tigers, kicking off their 2024 campaign. And of course, Devin and Marver will update you on what's going on in the NCAA tournament. It's been wild. Hey, the Illini looking good so far, getting back to the Sweet 16 for the first time in 19 years. But for now, hey, Devin, Marver, let's hear it.
Well, we are just about done with our first week into March Madness. How many of your brackets are already destroyed, Marvelous? I'm sure you've heard from somebody just bitching and moan about one team that has ruined everything for them today or this week.
I'm glad that I don't bet on 19-year-olds because it's just a 40-minute game, anything can happen. I mean, you have your Oaklands, obviously. It'd be Kentucky. That was the most unexpected one. And, you had a few others that your so-called Cinderellas, and that's what makes the tournament interesting. What makes it uninteresting is that there are four or six or eight teams that should be in the tournament that aren't. And I have a solution, actually. Just play day games in Dayton in the first week, and then you can put in four more teams, and you have 72 teams, and then your Indiana States and Memphis's and Oklahoma's and your St. John's won't be moaning, but you'll have other teams there moaning, so you just have fewer teams moaning. That's my solution. There it goes, NCAA. Take that. First eight instead of first four.
Like the way you think, Marv, only people that will be moaning will be a few teams and a bunch of people who just like to, pick the teams based on their favorite colors. The second round of the NCAA tournament wraps up tonight. And we know the Illini are in the Sweet 16 after beating Duquesne, and they're going to face Iowa State. The Illini have been dominant in both of their games so far. So, Marv, what do you think has been the Illini's secret to success?
Well, their secret to success is that they got to play Duquesne, who was one of the upset victims. Oftentimes, that's what happens. You have a team that wins a game they're not supposed to, and then you get kind of a walkover in the second round. So that was one thing to their advantage. But I think that they're a strong enough team. They're good. They're well balanced, and they did very well in the Big Ten. I believe that they were in second place. So, and they won the Big Ten tournament. So they definitely have had a good season, and I think they're hot at the right time. So, and they have all their players back, which is a key too. And Damask has been an outstanding addition from Southern Illinois, obviously. And he's really sort of been the last piece they needed to make them a contender for, Final Four and maybe beyond.
All right, Marver. At the time of recording, this game is not officially over yet. Northwestern has a tough matchup tonight against UConn. That we don't know the outcome just yet. If you're listening, you probably do know this, but excuse me, I got tongue-tied there for a hot second. But I guess, Marver, what are your thoughts on potential Illini-Northwestern regional final?
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's going to happen. I think I'm picking Connecticut, and it's funny that Northwestern, in their first two games, had to play two of the teams that were in the Final Four last year. Obviously, that's just a coincidence, and you'll notice that Dusty May is now the coach at Michigan, who was at Florida Atlantic. So it didn't take long for him to be grabbed up. I thought that he might have been grabbed up last year, but they were one of the Cinderellas last year, and they managed to get to the second round this year and got beat by Northwestern, and now he's in the Big Ten. But I think that UConn is just too strong. They have too much size. And Northwestern is a little bit banged up still. And Boo Booey won't be able to do it himself. And, I think he's been there about 10 years, so this will probably be his last game.
Might be his last game.
Which brings me to my next point.
Which is?
I'm not, the portal opened up on Monday, right?
Correct.
Which was why a lot of the NIT teams declined. That was one reason. Another is because they were pissed off that they didn't get invited to the big dance. But it's fine. The NIT is going to work out just great. I'm just sorry that Butler didn't get to play on their home court in the finals, but Indiana State will, in my opinion. So they'll be a local team. And, of course, Cincinnati is not too far away either. Those are some of the teams that were passed over. Some of the so-called blue bloods. I mean, even Seton Hall looks pretty good, and they should have been in the other tournament. But in terms of the big dance, in answer to your question, I'm favoring Connecticut. I don't think you'll see Illinois Northwestern times three here, but we'll see what happens, and you'll already know what happened when you're hearing us.
The joys of pre-recorded radio at a station that doesn't want you to go live. Okay, Marvelous. One of your teams, the DePaul Blue Demons recently hired a new head coach in Chris Holtmann. His coaching staff starting to come together and includes SIU head coach Brian, or former SIU head coach, I should say, Brian Mullins. Give us your thoughts on that hire.
Yeah. Well, that was a good hire for DePaul to get an experienced guy from the Big East. I'm surprised he took the job. You know, at 51, you don't really want to take a dead-end job like he did, but it's his choice. One good thing about hiring Mullins is that he brought along one of his players already, D'Amato, who was at Southern Illinois last year, is committed to DePaul. So sometimes that helps. And you'll have to explain to me, I've asked the athletic director at DePaul, Dwayne Peavy and others, about the NIL. They asked for money to help them build up the program with the NIL, which is name, image, likeness. And to me, I know for a fact that Caitlin Clark got money from Allstate to do that Allstate commercial. So does that mean that they need money to pay the athletes to come to school? I guess that's what it is. I mean, heresy. I mean, I'm a big advocate of amateur athletics. I mean, and between February 10th and March 10th, I saw 30 games all amateur. And if that's what's happening, I'm kind of disappointed. If that's really what's happening, I'm contributing, let's say, to DePaul, so they're going to pay people to come there. Is that what it is? I mean, nobody's explained it to me yet. Do you know what NIL means?
At the rate they're going, Marvelous, I think they need to pay you for how many games you go to.
Well, I've actually followed DePaul, sadly, since the 70s, when they were actually in the Final Four against Larry Bird, Indiana State, in a game that had gone the other way, and it might have. There never would have been a magic Larry Bird game, which was the biggest audience in history, when Michigan State and Indiana State in the finals in 79. But since then, it's been slim pickings. And it is an interesting hire in Holtmann. And I don't think that no matter what they do, they've never won more than like 7 or 9 games in the Big East since they've been in it. And no matter what they do, if they break 500 in the league, that's going to be, I think, the high end of their accomplishment. And I argued that they never should have been in that league. I mean, they should be with Loyola in the Atlantic 10, and they'd be a lot happier. But I guess money's involved and whatever else. So it is what it is. And they were, you know, as you may know, they were 3-29 this year and 0-20 in the conference. So the numbers speak for themselves. And you know, hopefully they'll be able to recruit. They've started again with D'Amato, who was a Niles Notre Dame graduate, having transferred under the portal from Southern Illinois already to join his former coach, who's an assistant. And, you know, they have a nice arena down there. They say that that's a big recruiting tool, and I don't think that it really is. They say it's better for the students to get there, and I don't think it really is. And, you know, I think that it's a situation that with the current state of athletics, DePaul will maybe get into a tournament, maybe NIT and such. And they were in a couple tournaments such as that. They're in the NIT, you know, in this century. They got to the finals of the CBA against South Florida and Max Struess's last year. But since I'm a DePaul historian, I'll stop. But in any event, the tournament, you know, it's well hyped, overhyped. You know, I'm talking about the NCAA, and you know, there's going to be a Final Four in Phoenix, on April 6th and April 8th, and you know, it's exciting. It's good to see teams that come up and snipe a power team like Oakland did over Kentucky. It makes it kind of exciting. James Madison over Wisconsin is another one. And that was also kind of amusing. James Madison beat a school from Madison. And then in the next game, they play Duke, and their nickname is Dukes, but, you know, be that as it may. But that's another game that's occurring as we speak, and I assume Duke will win that one, another blue blood. And the Big East actually overall is doing well. They allowed only three teams in this year, remarkably, which is the lowest I can ever remember. And so far, should Connecticut win, they'll be three. They'll be undefeated because of the you know, Marquette and Creighton are still alive. So I expect those. I expected those teams to do well, and I still like Houston. I'm kind of not sure anymore about them because they had such a bad final against Iowa State in the in their tournament in the Big 12, which will be the Big 18 next year. And Iowa State plays Illinois next, and I think that might be the end of the road for Illinois. So we'll just see what happens. They will be in the Sweet 16, and you know, they may meet their match there. I saw Iowa State earlier in the year, and they're very balanced and they're a very good team, and they won the Big 12 conference tournament championship. So they'll be a formidable opponent for Illinois and in the Sweet 16 round.
All right, Marvelous, we're coming up on our final few minutes here, so I guess let's just go with a few of the, you know, bullet points. What was your favorite upset of the tournament so far?
Well, I clearly it was Oakland over Kentucky. I thought that was unbelievable. They were like unconscious from 3-point range, and that makes a big difference. If a team is like, you know, Steph Curry-ing it during 3-point range, you know that's a great equalizer, even if the other team has arguably more skill and, you know, and such, and they're the so-called blue blood. So it's always fun to see the so-called blue blood. And Calipari, to me, you know, is overhyped too as a coach, and and that's sorry to see him lose personally, but I feel bad for the kids. Of course, they're very young, Kentucky, so they'll be pretty good as usual. But that was my favorite, and James Madison over Wisconsin was my second choice as to an interesting game because of the mid major beating a major, basically what it amounts to in that situation. So those are the two that were kind of interesting to me.
I guess I'll ask you the exact opposite question. Who's looked the best in the tournament so far? And if you had a favorite, Marvelous, who do you think, as of right now, is going to win the entire tournament?
Well, I mean, actually, I thought that Purdue has had kind of an unfortunate history with their 7'4" Edie. I thought that they, do really well last year, and they lost to Fairleigh Dickinson right away. But they've advanced to the Sweet 16. And I like them now that they've gotten past the first couple rounds to maybe get to the Final Four. And I also I think that they might get there, since this is Edie's last time around. They might gather around him and because he's unstoppable, and they just need to be stronger in a supporting cast, and that's the key. I mean, if they triple team Edie, there are other people open with outside shots like Lance Jones and others have to step up and Lawyer. So that's the key. They just have to be able to hit the shots when Edie is surrounded. But I like them. I still kind of like Houston, although, and now he's, like I say, Iowa State beat them in last week, so soundly. So they're another contender too. But from the Big East, you've got Connecticut, Marquette, and Creighton still alive. And I saw three of them play this year, and they're all very good. So, they could be contenders too for the Final Four, for Connecticut to repeat. And there might be somebody that sneaks in there. You never know. Last year, San Diego State snuck into the final. So you may have somebody like that. Like I say, a bunch of 19 and 20 year olds on a given day in a 40 minute game with lengthier than usual TV timeouts. They'll be, to pay the bills. They, an upset can occur. It certainly is possible, but I expect some of the teams that I mentioned just now to be contenders for the championship. I mean, Duke is strong too, but I don't see them going to the Final Four. But other than that, that about covers that. North Carolina too. I don't see them getting the Final Four, either one of them. Just the ones that I named above, pretty much.
And that's why that's the man you need to listen to before you guys make your brackets. Anyone? Marvelous. Final words.
Too late.
In the future, Marvelous, any final words for us?
Yeah, like I say, in the future, my keys a key points in this episode were expand the tournament to 72. You listen, guys, it's not a big deal. Just have afternoon games in Dayton. There'll be less moaning. There'll still be some moaning, but they won't have as much cause to moan if you have four more teams in. It's still be a quite interesting tournament. You know, you have day games on Thursday and Friday, so weighing in on Tuesday, Wednesday. Maybe that'll help you make a little bit more money, NCAA. And somebody will have to explain to me the portal in the NIL. So one of you listeners, explain to me the portal. How come guys still get to play 5 years, even though the COVID year is technically pretty much over? And I want to know what these graduate students actually study in their graduate year in college. So somebody will have to honestly explain that to me. And when they play with five different schools, they actually studying something when they're playing college basketball as a graduate student in their fifth year. Help me with that, everybody, okay?
Marvelous. Time for us to go back to school, and we got to go to break. So tweet us at Sports Cubicle TV. What do you think of the games? Is your bracket busted, or are you one of the lucky few? We got more coming up next.
And we keep things rolling here on the Sports Cubicle. I'm your host, Mike Mercado. He's the one. He's the only. He's Paul Shavari. And Paulie, you and I were going to come in here, and we were going to talk about the grand stage of opening day in baseball, even though it's South Korea, but still, nonetheless, opening day in its own right. And a few weeks from now, a few days from now, actually, we will be seeing opening day across baseball. But that's not the story we're going to talk about. We're not going to talk about the two-game series in South Korea. We're not going to talk about new places and new faces. We are going to talk about this unbelievable, earth-shattering, sports-changing story that broke overnight or while games were going on in South Korea. The Dodgers have fired Shohei Ohtani's interpreter amid allegations of massive theft or, as what was first reported, gambling. So we're going to let's whiteboard this really fast before I get into this.
Wait, hold up. Major League Baseball has a gambling problem?
Go figure. This is before we get in. Let's whiteboard this right before we get into this article I got from Tisha Thompson over at ESPN. The story comes out that there had been wire transfers, right, of over $4 million going from Shohei Ohtani's account to a bookie, essentially a sports book. But a few things to take into account, obviously.
An illegal sports book, though.
And not just an illegal one, obviously, because California gambling is illegal.
Oh, you can't sport, okay. I didn't know that. You'd think California, proximity to Nevada, the fact that Illinois and Massachusetts, all these different places, you'd think California would have legalized gambling, but that doesn't matter anyway.
No. So let's get into this article from Tisha Thompson, who was a big part of this investigation. This is from ESPN. Dodgers fire Shohei Ohtani interpreter amid allegations of massive theft. The Los Angeles Dodgers interpreter for Shohei Ohtani was fired Wednesday afternoon after questions surrounding at least $4.5 million in wire transfers sent from Ohtani's bank account to a bookmaking operation set off a series of events. Mizuhara, the longtime friend interpreter for Ohtani, incurred the gambling debts to a Southern California bookmaking operation that is under federal investigation, multiple sources told ESPN. How he came to lose his job started with reporters asking questions about the wire transfers. Initially, a spokesperson for Ohtani told ESPN the slugger had transferred the funds to cover Mizuhara's gambling debt. The spokesperson presented Mizuhara to ESPN, Paul, for a 90-minute interview on Tuesday night, during which Mizuhara laid out his account in great detail.
Now, time out. If Mizuhara is going to grant that interview with ESPN, did he talk to a lawyer first? Did he talk to the team first? That seems like where the story gets messed up right there. They could have swept this thing right under the rug, but now we have questions. And keep in mind, this is the day before the season opens in South Korea.
So let's go a little bit more into this article, as Paul was saying, because this is so in detail. However, as ESPN prepared to publish the story Wednesday, the spokesman disavowed Mizuhara's account and said Ohtani's lawyers would issue a statement. Quote, in the course of responding to recent media inquiries, we discovered that Shohei has been the victim of a massive theft, and we are turning the matter over to the authorities, read the statement from Burke Brettler, LLP. The spokesman declined to answer any further questions, and the statement did not specify whom they believe perpetrated the alleged theft. When asked by ESPN on Wednesday afternoon after the statement from the lawyers if he had been accused of theft, Mizuhara said he was told he could not comment but declined to say by whom.
Okay, so with it being an illegal operation, you know, so like a bookie that's you know, going under the radar. And the bookie actually did get raided by the feds, which is kind of, I think, how ESPN got wind of the whole thing. How did ESPN find out about this before the Dodgers found out about this? How did ESPN find out about this before Major League Baseball found out about this? Why is it that we're hearing this guy saying that Shohei never had anything to do with this, yet the bookie was saying to his, allegedly saying to his other customers that Shohei was a client? Why is it that Ohtani was trying to disavow any knowledge of this happening, yet we have two different verified transactions of large sums of money under his name that he, you know, that he transferred? There's a lot here. And of course, I don't want the court of public opinion is already like, well, this exonerates Pete Rose. And it's like, well, hold up. We don't really know the full story yet. What I would want to believe is that Shohei was never doing any gambling. His buddy was. But since Shohei makes so much money, he's like, here, here's some money. Go do it. Go have some fun. You know, whatever. But of course, the house always wins. You can't really make money at gambling and be a professional gambler at sports gambling. And of course, already a conflict of interest because this guy is an employee of a major league team. But of course, this guy probably doesn't understand it. I don't know what the laws are in Japan. I don't know what gambling is like in Japan, if it's even legal or not. But even then, so many red flags, such a minefield. And if Shohei Ohtani was found that he was knowingly gambling, even if it wasn't on baseball, that's a huge problem. Now, if he wasn't gambling on baseball, I would think, if we find out that, yes, Shohei Ohtani wasn't gambling on baseball, but he was gambling on other sports, should he be banned from baseball for life? I don't know. I don't know what the rule is. I always thought the rule was you shouldn't gamble on baseball, but I know that that rule's probably since changed to you can't gamble on any sports. So I would like to think that if Ohtani's guilty but never gambled on baseball, that it would be like, you know, the alleged Michael Jordan suspension, which was, you know, he went and go, you know, does that mean Shohei is going to chase his dream of playing basketball?
With the Cubs.
Wait, what?
I know what I said. We are okay with what's happening. We have no judgment on our side.
Or is this going to be a lifetime ban for, like, the face of 21st century baseball? How tragic would that be? But of course, this is such a Major League Baseball thing to happen on opening day, like the worst possible scenario that you could expect. And of course, where's Rob Manfred? Where's the statement? What's Major League Baseball saying about this? And they're trying to say that he's cleared of any wrongdoing, and it sounds like they don't even really know what's going on. And it sounds like it could be even worse. Now, that's taking out the whole thing where any sort of illegal gambling like that is a criminal activity. Ohtani could be facing prison time.
Asked why Ohtani didn't simply give him the money instead of paying the loan that he had to. He didn't want me to gamble it away. I want everyone to know Shohei had zero involvement in betting. I want people to know I did not know this was illegal. I learned my lesson the hard way. I will never do sports betting ever again. He also said that he'd never bet on baseball. That's 100%. I knew that rule. We have a meeting about that in spring training. He only bet on NFL, college football, international soccer, and the NBA. Regardless of what Shohei Ohtani knew or didn't know, whatever is going on with Mizuhara and his involvement, as much as he involved Shohei Ohtani, if this right here is as good as the story gets for Shohei, which means any other news that trickles down, any other investigation that's going to happen right now, it's only going to get worse for everybody involved. And I think right now what you're seeing is Dodgers and Shohei lawyers trying to put everything in a position in which it is going to fall in Mizuhara. But if one red flag pops up, if one wrong booking number looks like it hit those books, Shohei is in trouble. But not just Shohei, Major League Baseball.
If Shohei gets away with this, he truly is the unicorn.
Are you a Care Bear?
I'm an intensive Care Bear.
Why does a bear need a crowbar?
I don't like to get my hands dirty.
And we keep things rolling here on the Sports Cubicle. I'm your host, Mike Mercado, and it has been a busy episode here on the Sports Cubicle. But I wanted to break down the news that just continues to be the headline here in Chicago. What is going on with the Chicago Bears? And now that we are in the era, the post-Justin Fields era, now looking into the future, will that be the Caleb Williams era? to break it down with us is friend of the show, best friend of the show, one of the best in the business. Make sure you check out all his work at Clocker Sports. Of course, Heavy on Sports. What else? We have Triple Zeros. We have Soaring Down South. He does it all. Even your taxes, if you pay him enough money, he's the one. He's the only. He's Josh Buckhalter. Josh, how you doing, my guy?
Hey, it's funny you mentioned the tax thing. No, I'm just kidding. Thanks for having me back, man. Always a pleasure to join you.
it is an absolute wonderful time to have you on. Not only do we have everything that's going on with the NFL draft, the NBA season is coming to the end in the next few weeks. We have all this Shohei Ohtani stuff going on. It has just been a crazy few weeks in the sports world. Whenever we think there's going to be a lull in the sports world, it seems to pick back up. But I want to get your thoughts on this, Josh. We haven't had a chance to talk on air. We were messaging back and forth. We've talked off mic about the last few weeks, the last few days, specifically with the Bears, starting with DeAndre Swift all the way to Keenan Allen, and then at the point where you're getting a sixth-round pick from the Steelers that could become a fourth-round pick for Justin Fields. A pro day has happened with Caleb Williams. I think it's really interesting, Josh, that the Bears have put themselves, in my eyes, in a position where a number one draft pick is coming into a team with a top-tier defense. Very interesting wide receiver duo in Keenan Allen and DJ Moore. A team that won seven games the year before that. A lot of interesting ways that they have built this team for a number one pick. Where are you at now that we are in the post-Justin era? Did you think, first off, that the Bears got a good haul, not even a haul, did the Bears do okay trading with Pittsburgh? And now that we're past that stage, where are you in this entire situation since the Justin Fields trade?
Well, I think, first of all, with the Pittsburgh trade, the last time they traded with Pittsburgh, it didn't really work out. So I'm gonna just hold my breath on that one. I think they did right by Justin. I think that was their primary goal and all that. So that out of the way. When you look at this roster and you think about the moves that you just mentioned, if you didn't know the names of the quarterbacks involved, the team involved, you might think that this team was going to be preparing for a run with whoever they already had under center. This is going to be a situation that's unique for Caleb Williams in that most of the time, number one overall picks go to horrible teams. The Bears are not a horrible team. They were coming into last season, but they're not this year. And so I think that's where a lot of the split feelings over Fields' trade is coming from, is that we're finally on the precipice of building a complete roster, and he doesn't get a chance to realize that, and that is very fair. But I think you and I, actually, last time that we did speak on air, we talked about how a lot of the writing was on the wall, about how a lot of I guess, the visuals of what we saw throughout the season just weren't there from the passing perspective. And then this past postseason, we had to watch as not only did C.J. Stroud become the arguably the greatest rookie season ever, right? Going to the playoffs with a roster that nobody would have predicted. But then Patrick Mahomes went and won a Super Bowl, the third Super Bowl, with a wide receiver with me out there catching passes, right? He didn't have anybody of note coming into the year. So when you have those two things and Ryan Poles at the helm, I think it was a decision that ultimately makes the most sense.
And I think Bears fans have kind of had to come to terms with that. I've never seen so much divisiveness based off of a quarterback here in Chicago. I mean, it is very much a weird situation because Chicago doesn't know quarterbacks. And I think that's also something that we have to kind of exercise ourselves from the media standpoint to the fan base, is we've never seen this type of scenario. We've never seen the type of attachment Bears had on a guy who is very likable off the field, does some amazing stuff on the field, seems to be liked by his teammates, seems to have all the potential in the world in Justin Fields. And then now you have this prospect in Caleb Williams, who, of course, he doesn't fit the mold of the cookie cutter number one pick, just going to say, oh, shucks, I'm so happy to be number one. No, he has the power. He knows he has the skill, and he's going to make sure he ruffles some feathers along the way until he is in camp. Now, I think this, Josh, and this has been my opinion, I want to bounce this off of you. It doesn't matter who the number one pick is. It has never mattered who the number one pick is in the NFL. If it's a quarterback who is the highly talented prospect that is supposed to go number one, there is always weird stories. There is always weird drama. There's always something coming from the left, the right, the middle, the center about this guy wants this. He actually wants that. He'll only play here if it's 72 degrees there. It always seems. And then as soon as the number one pick goes in and they put pads on, it all goes away because the NFL is the NFL. Is that going to be the case here where all this is just noise? And on April 25th, when they finally announced that the Bears are on the clock and we hear those chimes go off, it's just going to be Caleb Williams being selected number one.
If they went any other direction than Caleb Williams, I think the entire NFL world would just kind of all lose their breath at the same time. It'd be the quietest day on the planet. But beyond that, if you look just at the last, again, looking at examples that the Bears are familiar with, C.J. Stroud had his test scores leaked, and that ended up causing him to slip, or I guess in the eyes of some evaluators. Justin Fields had the epilepsy story when he was coming out of college, and that caused him to fall down to the 11th pick, right? So I would imagine that there's going to be some impact in some some evaluators' eyes, but the prospect is the prospect, like you said, and a lot of teams, if they're already in love or enamored with that prospect, they're going to take him no matter what. And in Williams' case, I heard the example brought up. Fields kind of fit in this city because it's a blue-collar town, and he was a hardworking guy. Lunch pail, going to, you know, quietly go about his work. He's not out there trying to tout himself. He's out there trying to do his thing and put in the effort. Caleb Williams, not to say he's not that guy, but he's a different type of dude. And I heard it brought up as you got to be prepared for that. And I thought to myself, I grew up in an era where we assumed that quarterbacks were different types of dudes. Like the quarterback was just a different kind of guy. He had to be different mentally, just like wide receivers had to be a little bit different. Cornerbacks, a little bit different. And so it's almost surprising to me to hear the reaction to Williams is, you know, eccentricities, I guess it is, with his painting his nails, and he went to go. These are things that can he play? Can he play on Sunday? Will it? Are they going to protect him? Are they going to have guys who can run the routes? And I think the savviest part was getting a guy like Keenan Allen, because they're friends. This is somebody who's going to help him be more comfortable in a new environment where there may be some tension. I don't expect there to be a lot, if there is any at all, but it's nice to know that the Bears seem to be putting in safeguards to protect themselves from their own terrible history.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because to me, that's the biggest thing about a quarterback that's supposed to be generational, that's supposed to be can't miss, is dummy proof, is organizational proof. It doesn't matter where they get drafted. Their greatness, their skill is going to elevate everybody. I don't like this whole conversation either about, I get it, I understand it, of, well, they have a defensive-minded head coach in Matt Eberflus. One, for this season, we have to see how it plays out next season. There's no guarantees. But also, if Caleb Williams is this dude, is that dude, it doesn't matter who the OC is, because they're going to elevate talent. Like you just mentioned, they had us out there winning a Super Bowl with Patrick Mahomes. They can do this with, as long as the quarterback is the guy, is the right pick, and is in that situation, then you should be fine as an anchor. But I think it's really weird that Bears fans are always constantly looking into the future, worrying about these type of things before the pick has even been made yet. And I also want to be fair to Caleb Williams, just like Justin Fields, where it's expectations, and he's going to come into a town, into a team, like you said, with Keenan Allen, DJ Moore. They've brought in some offensive line help. They're going to invest even more with the number 9 pick in this NFL draft. Their defense is top tier. There's expectations to come in as the number 1 pick, a former Heisman winner, and to get from 7 to 10 wins, to win or compete in a NFC North with a depleted Minnesota Vikings team, and trying to see how real Detroit is going to be in the following year. How is that going to impact Caleb, having those type of expectations? To me, it's, if he's that dude, it's just going to be another day of greatness for his entire journey.
I would say that as Caleb Williams, and I think he's actually said this, but expectations have been his entire life, especially since he started playing football. So I don't think it'll be anything new. And when you talk about maybe it's a different level, so there's a different, you know, a different intensity, that's where having a guy like Keenan Allen in the locker room can help. He's a savvy veteran. He's seen expectations on a young quarterback in Justin Herbert and how they can impact him. He knows the type of things, the signs maybe to look for if it's impacting him negatively in any way. So I don't think it'll have that. I think the biggest thing for him is just going to be proven to the guys that he is that dude, and that's going to come through work. He can't do that outside of or off the football field. That's going to have to come in training camp and in games.
Josh Ballculture joins us for just another minute or so. He's our best friend. Make sure you're checking out all his work at Clocker Sports, at Heavy on Sports on Twitter, of course. That's heavy.com. And he's got everything from Soaring Down South and Clocker and Triple Zeros. And he's doing all amazing work, doing stuff in the NFL when the Bears are making these huge noise and big moves. And I can't wait to see your work come April 25th, come draft weekend. But Josh, there's one thing I want to talk about. Not necessarily the Bulls. That goes to show you how crazy the sports news zeitgeist is, where we don't want to talk about the Chicago Bulls. And, you know, let's be honest, we don't want to talk about the Chicago Bulls. Let's talk about them when they're a few games above 500. But Josh, I want to ask you this. It seems to me these news articles that I keep reading, that the temperament in sports talk right now is how great ratings are, how great TV deals are, how great everything just seems to be in the sports bubble. It looks like the NBA is really finding themselves in a difficult position. It seems like Adam Silver is in a point right now where his players don't seem happy. They don't seem very much entrusting in him. The Players Association seems to be a big disconnect between a lot of different levels of players in this league. And it seems like there's not as much fanfare as there is. And a lot of things coming out of that All-Star weekend. What are your thoughts? What are your feelings? What are your vibes as you cover the Atlanta Hawks, as you're watching the Chicago Bulls, as you're dissecting the entire NBA on the vibes from the fan bases, the spectators, and the way we're covering this NBA season in specifically?
I think that there is a mixture of excitement on the budding stardom that is going on around the league in different cities, but there is a bitter frustration in the level of play. People want to see stars play. We're getting a lot, still having to deal with people, injuries and rest and all that kind of stuff. Now, who's to say which is which? You know, they try to implement the rules to get players to play 65 games and all that kind of stuff. A lot of players, especially when they get older, don't care about the awards, or guys who aren't in the running anyway won't care. So those are always kind of short-sighted. I think the problem that Adam Silver has is that he followed a guy in David Stern who was pretty strong, who was pretty a formidable, I don't want to say opponent, but a formidable rival, right? In these deals with both sides of the league and the players. So he's gotta pick a lane and stick with it, I guess, because he seemed to be a waffler at inopportune moments. And so I don't know what he can do to get it back, because you can't force guys to do what they don't want to do. But you're right. There's a definite disconnect in what the fans want and what they're actually getting from the NBA product on a nightly basis.
Let's leave the folks, the good folks in Chicago on this. Not necessarily in the Eastern Conference. On the Western Conference, are the top of the standings fake? Is the entire standings themselves fake? When we get to playoff time, is it going to be OKC? Is it going to be Minnesota? Is it going to be the rise of Edwards and Shane Gillis and all these different people? Is it finally that moment? Are we going to get to playoff time and these guys that we normally hear from are going to be the ones that make the run? Or is it as simple as the Joker's going to the finals again?
So it's probably as simple as the Joker's going to the finals again. But beyond that, then you have to think about the guys that you're talking about, the usual suspects, the LeBrons, the Currys. Those guys' teams aren't that good now. So there's a legitimate chance that they are where they are because that's just what they are. They're not that good. So I would typically side with experience over the youthful upcomings of the Thunder and the Timberwolves. But in a year like this, this could be a transitional period for the NBA. But in the end, I still think the Nuggets win it.
Josh, any final thoughts for your peoples here in Chicago? As of course, they can check out all the work, heavy.com. Of course, they can check out all the work, Soaring Down South and Clocker Sports and Triple Zeros. Is there anything else that the good people should know?
Man, just embrace the future, guys. Don't be afraid to let the future come to you. It's an exciting time to be a Bears fan. It's an exciting time to be a Bulls fan, just because anything can happen at any moment. And so follow Clocker Sports to keep up with all the latest news.
And of course, you can see all that great coverage over at Clocker Sports. And we'll be having the great Josh Buchalter from Clocker Sports and all those other places he works as we get closer and closer past the April 25th draft. I can't wait to have you on the show then, as we're going to break down and try to get Chicago through all this craziness. He is Josh Buchalter. Check out all his work at Twitter at Josh G Buck. You can check out all the links to all the amazing work him and the team are doing. Josh, thank you so much, my brother.
Thanks for having me, man.
We got more coming up next here on the Sports Cubicle. I'm Mike Mercado.
Is there anything to be excited about for baseball season on the South Side, Paul?
They're still playing baseball in Chicago. They haven't moved.
Is it worth it, though, in the long haul?
If you like seeing Major League Baseball and American League teams, there's going to be a lot of them coming into town.
Now, what if you like seeing a minor league team posing as a major league team?
I don't really prefer that, but I do like minor league baseball. I like baseball in general. I'll go see a good little league game if I can.
Okay, don't say that again. That's creepy as all heck right now. But I'm talking about the White Sox, Palacios, because they're probably going to play like a little league team in the majors this year, which I think is just going to be downright just disappointing. You know, they got rid of Dylan Cease, which I honestly say good riddance. It probably is a move that, you know, is going to benefit the White Sox in the long haul. We're going to get revenge on that good old James Shields trade, hopefully. But just looking at the team roster right now, it's like, what is Tukey Toussaint going to be our opening day starter? Tim Hill going to be our opening day? It's just so, like,
well, and the fact that Michael Kopech gets moved to the bullpen, Dylan Cease gets traded, who is, like you're right, Tukey Toussaint, a guy that wasn't even like on an opening day roster last season, he performed pretty well with the White Sox. You know, and then you have Chris Flexen, who was barely even, you know, a starter, almost, I think, expected to be a spot starter slash mop up reliever slash long reliever. And now I think he's been thrust into, you know, that role. I'm curious to see if Nick Nastriani, which I don't think he's even on a on the 40-man roster yet. You know, if they're going to have to make moves to put him on the 40-man roster if he's even going to make the team. So I'd assume that he's going to start the year in the minor leagues just based on the fact that they might tell you they're competing this season, but I don't think they're going to make any concessions to put themselves in a spot to compete this year. And I think the Cease trade was the official, yeah, this is technically a rebuild, regardless of what they want to call it. And I don't like when teams aren't upfront about it. I think White Sox Nation is smart enough to know that ever since Rick Hahn and Kenny Williams were fired and the trade deadline last season, that we're in the midst of a rebuild. And there's no way that they're going to get themselves out of it quickly unless they have one of the most savvy GMs in the world in rookie Chris Getz, or they start spending money on big name free agents, which most seem to be getting locked up into long term deals anyway. So it's not like we're, you know, faced with big, you know, and I know Shohei Ohtani, but that's kind of, you know, he is the unicorn. There's no way the White Sox were ever going to be in play for him, nor should they have been, because if they're going to tie up that much money into one player, I think that's going to limit them on paying other guys or giving secondary contracts to Luis Robert, Yoan Moncada, Eloy Jimenez, assuming that they want to hold on to those guys beyond what they have them for, which Moncada is an example. This could be a big year for Yoan Moncada, and will the team be able to afford him if they're going to bring him back in 2025, assuming that they don't trade him in July of 2024?
I mean, this would be the year they could finally trade him because, you know, it's the fattest year of his contract. And, of course, he's playing for next year. A lot of these guys are playing for jobs here, Paulacious. And just it's so just disappointing because this is it's a rebuild. We all knew they were going to get the big names. Jerry did that press conference where he said they weren't going after Ohtani, which I thought for sure. Because doesn't that seem like the most White Sox thing to do? Get Ohtani and fix nothing.
Well, if they were going to get Ohtani, it's not because they have a blank check and they signed him. It was, you know, the rumors that we heard before that they offered so much to try and get him the last few years. But then could you imagine if Shohei Ohtani played 2023 with the White Sox and then became a free agent and left and went to the Dodgers? And then you got nothing. Then there would be no Dylan Cease or no Michael Kopech or no Eloy Jimenez or no, you know, whoever was offered in that deal.
But just knowing the logic of Jerry, it's like, this will put butts in seats. They'll come to see Ohtani.
Yeah.
And that's why I say it would be the most White Sox thing here. But just it's like we sat through the rebuild of what, 2017 to 2019, Paul?
Yeah,
it's just
yeah.
That, you know, we sat through that. We expected something different. And from 2020 to 2024, we got two playoff appearances, both knocked out in the first round. Did, you know, 2020, they had the best record in baseball before, you know, they started sucking halfway. Can I even say halfway through a season?
Once they qualified, I mean, 2020 is an anomaly just with the COVID pandemic shortened season, but they were the first American League team to qualify for the playoffs, and then they ended up seventh out of eight teams in the last 2 weeks. And I don't know if they just gave up because mission accomplished, they're in, let the rest take care of itself. You know, you're not fighting for like a buy into the division round or, you know, whatever the setup is now. So you're going to play a best of three regardless, but they probably had the opportunity to play it at home and they ended up playing it on the road in Oakland. And we all know what happened there. 2021, they were arguably riding off of the success they had of the first half of that season and limped their way into the playoffs in a very weak division and got exposed by a good Houston team. 2022 was supposed to be high expectations and they finish 500?
Yes, 500. And then last year, over 100
losses. And that was the surprising thing. So I thought, you know, the mindset going into 2023 was that they were going to improve because now they had a new manager. Now they didn't have Tony La Russa hampering things and they somehow got way worse. Now I get, okay, you can't really judge it 81 losses to 100 losses because there's going to be that element of, well, we're giving up anyway. We're putting out, you know, we're cycling in guys that we're trying out. So now we're even worse than we were projected to be by choice. So I get that to some extent. But this is a franchise that doesn't have too many 100 loss seasons and a fan base that takes a lot of pride in the fact that we've had some good winning teams, even though we haven't made the playoffs. So now that you have teams that are just awful, no hope for the future, no development. You know, like, I think people were willing to be patient with the 2017 to 2019 rebuild because you saw what the returns were with some of those trades. There were guys that were, you know, Yoan Moncada was the top prospect in baseball. You know, some of their draft picks, like Carson Fulmer, were supposed to be great, amazing players, and it never worked out. And ultimately, it really only ended with, well, Luis Robert, Dylan Cease, and Eloy Jimenez were really the only decent guys to come. I'm sure there might be someone else that I'm missing, but from that rebuild, the only guys that are really worth it, I think, were those guys. And now, flash forward to the fact that you don't have Dylan Cease anymore. Hopefully the prospects they got for him are going to be good. It seems like the, and I don't have the names in front of me, but the top pitching prospect that they got back is ultimately who, you know, the key piece of that trade is. But then when you think of the long term, okay, so you basically turned Jose Quintana into Dylan Cease into this new guy that they got, you know, from San Diego. And then, as we've seen with White Sox prospects, there's a good chance they might not even work out. You know, prospects in general. Baseball is so hard. It's not like basketball, hockey, football. Hockey's kind of a bad example, but basketball, football, you kind of know if a guy's drafted in the first round, he's probably going to end up being a good player, most likely not going to be a bust. With baseball, it's more of a roll of the dice. Just because a guy was drafted in the first round doesn't even mean he'll even crack the show. You know, he might, you know, kind of fizzle out in the majors. Mark Appel is a great example, drafted number one overall, and he never played in Major League Baseball. So it's possible that you can mess up a draft easily in baseball. And I wonder if the scouting department for the White Sox is capable of even finding good talent, you know, or are they going to have to get creative and do some of the moves that Chris, I do like some of the moves that Chris Getz had, like the Aaron Bummer trade that brought back Mike Soroka, who might end up being the opening day starter, or Nicky Lopez. They needed a middle infielder, you know, Braden Shoemake, another middle infielder, you know, and then I think there's a couple of like pitching prospects in there. You know, it's like they turned one guy that I think was expendable, very expendable, in Aaron Bummer, yes, and turned him into various roster positions. Now, ultimately, Bummer might end up having a better season than all of those guys combined, but the White Sox didn't have to spend so much money filling those positions for rental players that probably won't be there the next time the White Sox make the playoffs. And I think what I do like about this roster compared to years past is that it seems to be a focus on, you know, defense. Defense is going to be important with this team. And we saw that they had various bad, almost comically bad performances in the field.
Well, you had DHs playing every position.
Guys out of position. You know, guys that never played the outfield since the age of 12 as a major league outfielder. So hopefully some of that stuff is done. But this is only year one of the Chris Getz regime. So I'm hoping that whatever core he's going to build out of, you know, rises up to the top this season. You know, I guess there's some things to be excited about. There's still Luis Robert. Gavin Sheets, maybe off the bench, could have some good stuff as a lefty bat. You know, maybe Andrew Vaughn improves. Maybe, I don't know, you know, I don't know. After that, I really don't know what else. You know, Garrett Crochet. But, you know, it's like with Crochet, I think they're going to run into the same problem they had with Kopech. Here's a guy that just throws fireballs, complete fireballs. And with Kopech, he couldn't keep his pitch counts down. There was no way he was ever going to have a complete game shutout for you because he usually was at about 100 pitches by the fifth inning. So I always thought when they got Kopech, I was like, this guy would be a great closer someday. And if not, maybe a great setup guy. Well, now he's coming out of the bullpen anyway, so we'll see how Pedro Grifol ends up using him this season. But I want to see Garrett Crochet maybe in a closer role, although I think he was destined to be a starter. I'm just worried when it comes to guys like this, and we've seen it with both players already in their young careers, how many times are they going to need a Tommy John surgery to try and make them a starter every year? Whereas like maybe these guys are really just only good for about 30 to 50 pitches a week out of the bullpen. But That's just one man's opinion. I think it's just ironic, though, that Kopech ends up in the bullpen, even though 6 years ago when I suggested this, people were like, no, 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 you don't pay that guy that type of money to, you know, have him come out of the bullpen. It's like, well, where's the only spot where he's going to be good on this team? Because it sure wasn't top three starter in the rotation.
Well, we paid Andrew Benintendi how much to basically do what exactly?
Be a left-handed bat, I suppose.
But he doesn't even do that well.
Yeah.
And that's just the thing with this team, Paulie. It's just, it's like every move just kind of seems like...
It's bargain bin. Bin shopping.
We got Corey Lee, who's this great catching prospect, and who's going to be his veteran catcher? Martin
Maldonado. Yeah, yes. But Corey Lee probably won't even crack the opening day roster because you also have Max Stassi. So, Max Stassi might end up being the majority of the innings behind the plate, Maldonado there to maybe just help coach and guide the younger guys. But, there's also, Edgar Cuero, who they got in the Lucas Giolito trade to the Angels. He's supposed to be a great catching prospect as well. So you have two catching prospects that eventually should be, you know, your number one catcher, two guys going to fight it out. One of them probably won't end up being on the team in the long run, and one will, assuming that they're going to be good enough to play on the team. But then you got two veterans kind of log jamming that pipeline. But perhaps that might be a better thing. I think with an overhaul on a roster like this, I think veteran catchers are probably a smart thing. This ultimately, I think, is what Yasmani Grandal was supposed to bring to the table. But we kind of saw what happened there.
Yeah, and this is a much cheaper paycheck than, what, $64 million for Yasmani?
I'd rather take Martin Maldonado than Yasmani Grandal.
With the paycheck, I agree.
Yeah, but even with the production, because Grandal, while he's a great offensive guy, not much of a great defensive guy, and his offensive numbers have slipped over the years, whereas Maldonado's fairly consistent, and even if his numbers are slipping, I think he's going to provide more mentorship to some of these guys than what Grandal ever could bring to the table.
White Sox fans, it's not going to be fun.
Do you want to do the fun, quick predictions here? What record do you think they're going to end up with?
Well, I'm going to say this, Paulatius. This team cannot do better than last year's team. I don't see them winning more than 60 games.
I could see them being better than last year's team because I think they'll have more grit, more fight, and they won't be so complacent.
And that's so embarrassing.
But I still have them at like 66 wins.
I'm going 60.
Okay.
Worst, probably the worst in all of them.
Actually, I'm looking at my projections now. 65 is what I had them at. The Cease, I would have probably put them at like 69 to 70 wins before the Cease trade. But I think after that, it's like, I mean, that was your one star caliber pitcher. So,
and that's three more wins than they had last season, correct?
I believe so. Yeah, because they had 101 losses last year, so 61 and 101.
That's what
last
I believe.
Year. Yeah, so I originally had them about 10 wins more, but now I have them at 4 wins more. But going into last season, I had them at like 10 wins more because La Russa wasn't going to be there. And they got somehow worse.
It's there's so much. I think it's more than the manager. We need to go through the trainers, your hitting coaches, your pitching coaches. Clean bleeping house. Okay, Paulatius, my next prediction. There is a rule in MLB that every team has to have one representative of the All-Star game.
I think we're both in agreement that it'll be Luis Robert.
Probably.
But if it's not Robert, who is it?
Maybe.
So let's make a bold prediction.
I'm going to go and say, it would be funny to say Paul DeJong, but I'm going to probably give it to, I'd say Tanner Banks. That's my bold prediction.
Okay, yeah, and I think going pitcher is probably the more likely one because I think there's so many great position players that it'd be hard for, you know, like DeJong, if he got in as like a shortstop in the All-Star game, it's like, gosh, there's no good American League shortstops. You know, like this is a league that has like Corey Seager, the Seattle Mariners guy, Julio Rodriguez.
I can't name it really any good ones in the American League. National
I'm
League
still
easily,
in so like but... football and soccer mode that like getting into baseball mode this year has been difficult for me, and I think a lot of that has to do with the White Sox.
They suck. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. But you know, I don't know. Yeah, I guess like if I had to pick someone, let's say Garrett Crochet. If it's not Luis Robert, I'll say Garrett Crochet. But I like where you're going with Tanner Banks because I think he could be a surprise this year. He could be a guy that ends up having a career year for himself and, you know, having a good year for himself. Maybe not All-Star caliber, but maybe better for him because he should probably get more playing time than years past. But I don't know, Devin. We're probably going to complain about this for the next 6 months, so everyone should just buckle up.
I'd like for this team to surprise us, but the only time they surprise us, Paul, is when they lose and they shouldn't.
Yeah.
We got more coming up on the Sports Cubicle. Mercado, save us.
Sox next week again. I'm sorry, wait. Sox start Thursday where the Tigers come into town to kick off on opening day.
Lord have mercy on us all.
Hey, well, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the Sports Cubicle. I want to thank you all for listening. As you know, we got bonus content. You're listening to the podcast. We also have an American League preview. As you know, last week we had a special bonus National League preview for you. The baseball season starts this week, this Thursday. Of course, you can find all of our extra stuff, all of our content on YouTube. Just search for at the Sports Cubicle. Our stuff is found on SoundCloud, Spotify, whatever your favorite podcast source is. Chances are we're on there. Just search for the Sports Cubicle. You can find it soundcloud.com/WCPT820 along with all of the other WCPT 820 shows. So long, everybody. Hey, and congratulations to Jasmine Paris, the first woman to complete the Barkley Marathons. As you know, we talked to a filmmaker that covered the Barkley Marathons last year. Such a wild race, such a huge accomplishment. So congratulations to Jasmine as she became the first woman ever to do it. That'll do it for the Sports Cubicle. We will see you next week.